Today is Wednesday, December 9th, 2020. This is part 6 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Keith and Nancy Green, G-R-E-E-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Keith. How are you today?
I'm doing fine.
And it sounds like Nancy might join us in a little bit, so we'll get started here.
Okay.
Keith, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Oh, you bet.
Thank you. Last time in part 5, you talked about Roy Starkey, S-T-A-R-K-E-Y, and Roy's Beach and the USGS operations that he did there, checking water flow. And then Roy worked for the concessioner doing maintenance at the ranch, at Phantom Ranch.
Well, let me maybe clear that up a little bit.
Yeah.
He was working for the USGS doing those measurements of the river.
Right.
And, you know, sending it into Reston, Virginia on the mules. And then he got replaced by the tower, which is presently down there in the river on the north side, north end of the Black Ridge.
So he was
tower,
he was replaced by automation.
Yeah, and that tower then made all the measurements that USGS really seemed to want.
Okay.
And then it would, like, there was like a certain second of every week that it would broadcast the it would actually call Western Virginia and electronically forward all of the data that it had taken that week to the computers in Reston at the USGS headquarters. And so Roy was basically replaced by automation.
And so when he lost his job with the USGS, then did he just basically shift over and start working for Fred Harvey?
He stayed down there because, I mean, he was such a great guy and so much, you know, really a friend of everybody down there that he just stayed for a while, but his status was insecure until Terry Mache. And that would be probably 76.
Okay.
Made him the maintenance person at Phantom Ranch.
Okay.
And so he worked in that capacity. He was doing that anyway, you know, just trying to, you know, do the ditches and everything else that had to be done.
Right.
As long as it wasn't too complex. I mean, he couldn't fix the swamp that, I mean, he couldn't fix the freezer, for example, and the walk-in freezer.
Right. Right.
But he could, you know, do most other things.
That makes sense. Yeah.
And so, yeah.
So you talked about Roy and things he was doing. One of the other people that you mentioned that I wanted to know more about was during this time period of 75 to 85 was Gail Burak, B-U-R-A-K.
Right.
How'd you first meet Gail?
Probably when she was either a volunteer or a ranger at the Phantom Ranger Station.
Okay.
She worked there some, and she also, in the summertime, would be the kind of the volunteer ranger at Cottonwood.
Okay.
And she got to know the Aikens really well, so the Aikens would be a great source of Gail Burak stories. But
okay.
What I remember about her at at Cottonwood was, you know, you'd hike up there and she'd invite you to spend the night, and she'd always have cooked all this stuff. She was from New Hampshire, so she and she was very typically of that ilk, you know, New Hampshire-ish, you know, so she knew all these recipes that involved natural foods, organic foods, and she had, I remember she had on the counter in the Cottonwood Ranger Station, she had a whole like buckets, but not buckets, porcelain jars, I guess, of maybe brown rice or organic brown rice or flour or organic flour or, you know, all this stuff. And so she'd make all these, especially I remember cookies were really good, but they were totally natural, you know, and the no sugar, just honey, if anything, to sweeten it.
Nice.
It was really good. That's what I remember really a lot about her. And then she'd also give talks on the steps of the Ranger Station. She'd give an evening program to the campers down there. And, of course, she was always checking the campground and making sure everybody had permits and all that stuff.
Okay.
But, you know, I spent a lot of time with her, and she spent stories. She'd tell stories. I think my favorite story, Gail Burek's story, is how she originally came to the canyon to work, and this was before I knew her. She worked for the company that was mining copper, maybe, at Havasupai. I'm not sure what they were with the mine, but she was the cook for that company. That's how she first came to the canyon.
Okay.
And but anyway, on her time off, at times anyway, she would, and of course, this at a time when she was quite young, and she was in her 50s and maybe even 60s by the time I knew her.
Okay.
But she used to, in her younger years, I guess, she would hike down to Phantom, and she knew, like, the at the time, there was just a couple that would be running Phantom Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd hike down in the evening and get down to Phantom Ranch in the after dark. And of course, in the summertime, and of course, she'd take off all her clothes and jump in the swimming pool and cool off, and then get up on one of the lounge chairs and just go to sleep there, you know, being warm all night.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd sleep there. And then when she started noticing activity going on in the at the lodge, she'd get up and go help cook breakfast and help, you know, with whatever was going on at the lodge.
Cool.
She was, I guess, famous for being, for a time when she was hiking out of the canyon, and these two guys, you know, young guys, passed her and said, "Oh, wow, you know, it's nice to see an old person, you know, hiking." And, you know, they'd hike up, and eventually they have to stop and rest, and Gail would just come trudging by them and say hi. And so she'd usually beat the young folks out of the canyon.
Cool.
You know, after they said disparaging remarks about right. her age.
She'd say, it's good to see you young kids out here.
Exactly, exactly, I'm sure. Yeah, and I suppose another one of my favorite stories about Gail and Roy Starkey actually is one day it was everybody's day off and our day off, Roy and my day off anyway, and so we hiked up Phantom Creek, which is you have to hike north on the North Kaibab to about a mile, and then get off of the trail and go ford Bright Angel Creek, and then this little creek flowed into Bright Angel Creek from the west, and it was in its own little canyon and named Phantom Creek. And Phantom Creek, we'd hike up that, and it was really nice. It had, and still does, I'm sure, had places along the way where there was probably a hard rock or a schist bedding that came to the surface.
Yep.
And it created pools in the creek. And usually a set of three or four pools. And as you walked up the creek in these pools, then they were deep enough to where you might have to, you know, get down on your hands and knees to get wet all over, but they'd be, you know, kind of fun pools to go up. Some of them, though, were deep enough that you actually had to swim through them. So, anyway, Roy and I went up Phantom Creek to, there was a, I'm not sure if this was the time, but there had been a rock slide down off of Buddha Temple, and the rock slide had blocked up, had dammed up the creek, had dammed up Phantom Creek, and so it created a lake up above where the rock fall had fallen.
Okay.
And we call that Bowman Lake because Dave Bowman, who was also an employee at Phantom, had discovered it. Anyway, we went up to Bowman Lake, and then it was about maybe 6 miles up the creek, so it took all day, you know.
Wow,
it took
yeah.
a long time anyway to get up there. And then we swam in it, and Roy was a nudist. He loved to run around naked, and so did we. I pretty much everybody at Phantom did this, you know, that we just, you know, once we got off of the main trails, we could take off all our clothes, except for our shoes, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You had to have river shoes or tennis shoes that you get wet.
Yeah.
And we'd go up Phantom Creek. That was probably the most common place to go. But anyway, we'd go up Phantom Creek and anyway, we got up to these pools, and one of them, there was a pool just before where Bowman Lake was, where that was always there, where it had ledges, and you could actually jump off the ledge, and it was probably maybe 9 or 10 feet deep, the pool. Okay. It was pretty, that was a pretty fun place to go to. Anyway, you could go up there and etc. So anyway, me and Roy went up there, and we were, took some food and, you know, had a good time up there. And then on the way back, just before, there's a little waterfall in Phantom Creek just really maybe 100 yards up the creek from Bright Angel Creek,
okay,
from the confluence of Bright Angel Creek and that waterfall. Above that waterfall, then there was a kind of a little park, a flat area, flat, relatively flat for the bottom of the Grand Canyon, anyway, mm-hmm, area where there was kind of a you had to kind of there's a trail that had been, I don't know, created somehow, not by the Park Service or anything, but anyway, because it was the only way to get around some pools. Anyway, you could come through it, and there was a place where the rock walls were only maybe 3 feet apart. That you had to, a little place that you had to go through, and then you stepped down a few steps onto this flat plain, relatively flat plain, which is, oh, you know, we're only talking 50 yards maybe until it starts, you know, it's going down. The creek was off to your, if you're going down it, you know, the creek would be off to your right. And you, anyway, you could walk through this little gap, and you had to step down. And then, so anyway, me and Roy were coming down, and it was getting dark. It was starting to get, you know, the sun was low anyway, so it was starting to get dark a little bit. So, but we came along there, and we went through that little gap. Remember, both of us are naked, and there was a couple of guys that had built, were planning on camping there, which is an illegal camping place, huh, Phantom Creek, and they had built a fire.
Wow.
Actually, right along, right under that wall, which meant that there'd be carbon deposits on that wall for maybe 100 years or so from,
right,
one fire, you know. And so I, when we all of a sudden appeared coming through that rock wall and down to where they were, I started bawling them out for building a fire. And that, you know, I said, you're going to destroy, you know, there's going to be black marks from now on, you know, you need to put that fire out. And besides, this is illegal camping, blah, blah, blah. So, then me and Roy kept going, you know, went down past the waterfall where you had to put on clothes, and then down to the creek, to Bright Angel Creek, and across Bright Angel Creek. Oh, I guess we crossed Bright Angel Creek before we put on the clothes, but anyway, or maybe, well, anyway, and then up onto the North Kaibab Trail and on back down the mile down to Phantom Ranch. So, but anyway, when we got back to the ranch, I called the phone. You know, the phone line was one line, and it went through everything from the power house up at, up, you know, up north of Cottonwood, through Cottonwood, and all the way down to through Phantom Ranch and the Phantom Ranger Station and the River Ranger Station and up to Indian Garden and on up to the rim. Anyway, that one phone line, I picked up the phone and was able to get a hold of Gail, who was the only ranger down there. Well, she was, again, a volunteer, I believe, or maybe anyway, a ranger, and Gail was the ranger, and I said hi, and Gail immediately said, oh, and she recognized my voice and said, oh, hi, Keith, what's going on? And I said, oh, this isn't Keith, this is an anonymous caller, and I just want you to know that there's a couple of guys with a fire up Phantom Creek. And she says, oh, well, thank you, Anonymous, you know, because she, I mean, just playing in with the Anonymous.
She game. Ran with it.
Oh, thank you, Anonymous. I'll go check it out. And she did. She went up there and gave him a ticket for camping illegally and chased him out of there. But she called later and she said, God, geez, do you know any, you were up Phantom Creek, weren't you? And I said, well, yeah. And she said, do you know anything about two naked people that were, like, hiking up the... Because apparently these guys, it says, they were naked. and I said, oh, no. I didn't see anything like that when I was up there. And so we maintained the ruse.
Cool.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Gail, she was, you know, another person that I hung out with, and she told me lots of stories about, you know, being the old days, and that's, you know, her and Roy are really my sources of all the information I have for the old days of Phantom before I was there.
Okay. Yeah. Nice. Someone else I was interested in as well is Bob Topping.
Okay.
T-O-P-P-I-N-G.
Okay, Bob Topping was kind of a loudmouth partier. And he was constantly getting things going that were somewhat illegal and mostly just fun. Like one time I remember, there was a ranger. I don't remember his name, but there was a ranger that had come up to the ranch from the ranger station, and he was sitting in the back room having a cup of coffee with Terry, I think, with the manager. So and Topping gathered a bunch of us together, and he said, now, let's pretend that baking powder is like a kind of speed or something.
Like cocaine or something?
Drug. Let's call it like cocaine, yeah. Let's pretend it's like cocaine. And we'll snort baking powder and in front of him and see what happens, you know. And so he actually set up a ladder, a little like 6-foot ladder that you could sit on, and he'd take, you know, spoonfuls of this baking powder and hold it up to your nose, and we're supposed to snort it. And so I don't know why we did, but we did, and boy, did it sting going down.
I bet.
But Glenn, that was the ranger's name, but anyway, he never responded to it. But that was kind of a typical Topping prank.
Hmm.
He knew Brad Jones, who Brad Jones had gotten somehow. He was the manager of the hiking Grand Canyon Trail Guide,
yeah,
hiking company. He didn't own it or anything, but it was mainly based in the train station on the South Rim.
Right.
And Topping kind of installed himself in with that, with him, you know. And so, but Topping, you know, he was the kind of guy that, you know, he knew people. He knew, you know, he would recognize people and remember their names really well.
Oh, interesting.
He was really good at that.
Okay.
And, he knew the general manager, for example, of Fred Harvey on the South Rim, invited him into the train station. The train station had this really neat coffee table. There was a couch, and in front of it, this coffee table. But the coffee table was, you know, set so it was about maybe a foot off the ground. But it was actually an old sign for the motor lodge, and it had been, you know, shellacked and, you know, painted really nicely. So it was really, anyway, I remember sitting around there when the general manager came in and Topping, of course, you know, yakking away. And they actually smoked marijuana in there. I don't remember that exactly, but I remember the story about that.
How does the story go?
Even the general manager of Fred Harvey Company smoked pot back then. I mean, it was just a natural part of life for most of us back then. So, was smoking pot. So, Topping had a room there, and there's a whole bunch of things that happened to him, which I can't really think of right now. The thing I remember the most about Topping was that he loved to play cribbage, and so did I. You know, my grandfather had played cribbage, and my father had played cribbage. I mean, I remember when my father and my father would have to drive, or we'd have to drive all the way from Southern California up to Chico, California, which is, you know, at the time was at least a full day's drive all the way up there. And my dad and, you know, my dad and grandpa would get into the, would come into their house and say hello to grandma. And basically just within maybe 10 minutes, they'd be sitting at a cribbage board and playing cribbage. They were definitely into cribbage, and so cribbage was a part of my family, and it was part of my life, you know, for a long, long time. I used to play cribbage constantly with, I even learned how to play cribbage solitaire. Anyway, Topping was also a cribbage player, and actually a number of us were cribbage players at the time at Phantom Ranch. In fact, they had a piece of lumber. I think Topping had made that. It was a piece of lumber that was, it was a 2x12 maybe, a piece of lumber, and he cut off about two feet of it, and then with a drill press had drilled the 120 holes in it to create a cribbage board.
Oh, wow.
And we had, I think there were like railroad spikes or something like that. For pegs. And we'd play cribbage, I mean, so much that board got creases in it or places, you know, where the the pegs had been dragged along between the holes that were starting to wear down, and you know. So anyway, we used to play cribbage all the time, and usually competition. So you know, two games out of three would make you the winner of whatever competition that was, and so I probably would beat Topping half the time, but he wouldn't agree with that. He always called me, his nickname for me was number two. He always called me number two because he, of course, was number one in cribbage, and I was number two, according to him. Topping, the last time we saw Topping, it was pretty wild. It was, let's see, and Nancy knows this story better than me, but anyway, I believe we were, I think we were at the Kaibab Lodge on the North Rim.
Okay.
Nancy and I had spent the night there. I worked there for a while, but anyway, suddenly Topping appeared in the dining room, but there was nobody else in the dining room. It was just me. I guess it must have been when I was working there. I was a sous chef at there in 1982.
Okay.
And anyhow, we had, or maybe it was 85. It was 86 because it was after we got married. So anyway, or you know, me and my wife, anyway, Topping showed up with a woman who used to be a friend of ours. What was her name? I can't remember. Hmm. But anyway, he showed up with her, and he was wearing a dress.
Huh.
And we were, and Nancy and I were going, what are you doing? And he said, well, I lost my pants last night. I don't know where they ended up.
Hmm.
I said, but you're wearing a dress. And he says, he looks down at this dress he's wearing, and he goes, so? We're like, well, so, I don't know what's going on, but oh well.
Huh.
Anyway, that was the last time I saw Topping. He, apparently, before he left the South Rim, he gained confidence by a whole bunch of people, and he apparently, and I don't know this for sure, but he apparently stole cameras, really expensive cameras and stuff from several of my friends that were working up there, living up at the South Rim, and then just disappeared. And the last anybody heard from him, he was up in Yellowstone, running rivers along the Yellowstone River, the downriver from the park. Topping was a big promoter of running the river, and I went down the river several times with him.
Okay.
And others, you know, actually Brad Jones and Bob Topping. And,
when was that?
Don Furr, and that would have been, boy, when was that?
In that time period, 75 to 85?
Yeah, it was in the 70s. It was in the 70s. Anyway, yeah, we did the river several times, private river trips.
What do you remember about those trips?
Um, Well, I remember one of the things Cobbing would do is he'd say, okay, we'd be coming to a river, a rapid, and he'd say, okay, we need a, what did he call it? A hood ornament.
Huh.
We need a hood ornament. And we, which meant he needed, he wanted one of us, usually seemed like it was usually me, but anyway, he wanted to get to the front, on the front of the boat, with our hands, you know, holding on to the rope right in the front, and in order to hold the bow down, I guess it was the idea, but it meant that you had to eat all the waves that came through,
right,
came across the bow when you went through a rapid.
And then had to bail.
Room doing that.
Had to bail the water out of the boat.
Right. We, I remember one time it was in the lower part of the river. We stopped and Topping created a sweat lodge.
Oh.
Which was, you know, with pieces of tarp and the like, you know, people's tents and whatever, you know, in order to create a closed bubble,
mm-hmm,
thing, and then started a fire, you know, but using some driftwood and got rocks hot and, you know, the whole thing, you know, got that, put the all together, put the hot rocks in,
nice,
into a hole in the middle and of the between us all, and then poured water on it, of course,
mm-hmm,
make steam. So,
mm-hmm,
I remember doing that with him. He knew a lot about the river, and he knew a lot. I mean, he was just an amazing, had an amazing knowledge of everybody and everything going on there.
Wow. Okay.
He was a pretty incredible guy, except for, like I said, at the end it turned out he was also a thief. So.
Oh, yeah.
he disappeared and never appeared again. So I'm assuming that means that he really did steal all that stuff. And, and just didn't want to be seen again. He definitely never made contact with anybody at Grand Canyon after he left. And for all I know, he's not even alive anymore. Mm. Who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
Topping.
Yeah, okay. Who else do you remember was at Phantom Ranch, either managing the ranch or as a co-worker with you back in that 75 to 85 time period?
Well, there were the, there was Liz McCurry and Don Furr.
How do you spell Liz's last name?
M-E-C-U-R-I, that's a guess.
Okay.
And Don Furr, F-U-R-R.
Were these managers, or were they?
No, they're just workers.
Okay.
There's a whole lot of people, you know, we're talking.
Mm. Yeah.
Probably 50 or so altogether.
Okay.
Dan Tobin.
What do you remember about
brother,
Dan Tobin?
Dan Tobin.
T-O-B-I-N.
Right. He worked at Phantom for a while, not really very long. He met Terry Solar down there, and I remember one time. See, Dan had polio as a kid, as a young person, and so he had to wear a brace on one leg, and so he walked. I mean, he could walk, but he walked slowly. And he would hike in and out of the canyon on that, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
In itself, you know, that he did that. But one of my favorite stories about him was one time we talked to the Aikens who lived at the powerhouse. What is that, 8 miles? No, more than that. Oh, gosh. I can't remember how far it is. 9, 10 miles, anyway, north of Phantom, where the Aikens lived. Bruce Aiken and his wife, Mary, and their three kids.
Right.
They invited us up there, and so me and Dan decided to go on up for days off, and when we were getting ready to go, we were in the back room, and how did that get started? It was like one of the cooks was one of the cooks had suggested that he's gonna make a dessert that could be beat when we got back. And some other people who were also cooks at the time were, I mean, you know, everybody cooked back then. It was, you know, anyway, would say, oh, I know a recipe is even better than that, and blah, 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 blah. And so Dan said, okay, well, we're going up to the powerhouse, and when we come back, we'll have a contest and see whose dessert, and me and Keith will be the judges, and we'll see whose dessert is better, and we'll give a prize. And everybody, we didn't, and Dan was just kidding around, really, but they took it seriously. So anyway, so we hiked up to the powerhouse, and it took a long time, you know, but it was okay, you know, to get up there and spent some time at the powerhouse, and then came back. And when we got back, the cooks down there, Charlie Bongo, that's who it was. Charlie Bongo was one of the cooks, anyway. The cooks had each of them had made their dessert, you know, their what they thought would be our favorite dessert. And they were all sitting on the back room table when we got there. There was probably at least five different kinds of sweets, you know, desserts.
Wow.
And I mean, to be honest, you couldn't really eat very much, you more than one at a time. But we got back, and we had to be the judges of the best desserts. And we just thought it was pretty funny to take it seriously.
Could have started a tradition right there.
Yeah, really. And then was my roommate in for a while in cabin 11, which is now a revenue cabin, I'm pretty sure. But he was my roommate, and I remember he hated Joni Mitchell music, which was one of my favorite music. And I had kind of inherited the record player and had my record collection, which I'd brought from Oklahoma. I'd had it all shipped down there by mule. And so anyway, he hated Joni Mitchell. So every time I wanted to get it, to get his goat, I'd put on Joni Mitchell music. But he ended up taking one of my Joni Mitchell records and just sailing it across the room, and it just broke into 100 pieces. And but I mean, it wasn't like we were enemies or anything. He just did that one time. Actually, I don't think I was even there when he did that. He went off on his days off, and I came down, and there was my Joni Mitchell album all broken.
You mentioned Dan's wife-to-be, Terry. What was her last name?
Her last name was Solar. S-O-L-A-R.
Solar. What do you remember about Terry?
Well, again, another friend, a good friend. Several stories about Terry. Actually, I've been writing these stories down lately, but
good.
One of them, one time, she and I and Terry Mache, or Magda, as we're calling her these days, but Terry Mache and Billy Burns, I think that's all of us, that and Don Furr. Anyway, we'd read Boucher's book about how to get up to Sumner Butte.
Okay.
And it's kind of funny because the first time I tried to get up Sumner Butte, it was just me and Don Furr that read the little blurb what was his first name? Butchard?
Harvey.
Harvey, yeah. Harvey Butchard and his Grand Canyon Trek had written, you know, how to get up there. And we just read it and set down the book and went, oh, that sounds easy. Set the book down and started walking. And, of course, you know, we got up the Clear Creek Trail around the other side of Sumner Butte, and we knew you were supposed to go up. There's a wash there. Or a break there in the red wall, a big crack in the red wall, and we went, oh yeah, you just go up that. So like you just go up that, but we hiked up, of course, from the Clear Creek Trail, and what looks like it'd be about 100 yards turned out to be maybe a mile or so. It was quite an all uphill. You know, up to the base of the crack in the red wall, and the crack doesn't come all the way down to the bottom of the red wall. Well, the crack does, but you can't see through it all the way down to the bottom of the red wall, whereas you can see sky through it at the top of the crack. Anyway, we got up to the crack, and we're like, okay, now what? And we, of course, had forgotten how Harvey said to do it in the book. So that Don tried doing the thing where you put your feet on one side of the crack and your butt on the other side of the crack and kind of work your way up it.
Right.
And he got maybe 5 feet up, 10 feet up maybe, and before it got too wide to do that. So that wasn't going to work. And so anyway, we ended up coming back down without hiking up there. This time, of course, we took the book. So you have to walk over, and this is with Terry Mache, well, let's call her Magda then.
Okay.
Magda and Terry Solar. We got up to the foot of the red wall, and then you have to walk over about maybe 50 yards to the right, 20 yards, anyway, to the right a ways. And then there's a kind of a slot thing that comes down at an angle from the crack in the red wall.
Okay.
And if you walk up, you have to walk up this slot, which is maybe 3 feet, two or 3 feet wide, and then there's kind of a ridge on the outside, and it's a anyway, you can come down this sort of, I mean, you can see that water has come down it and kind of dug out this little trough there. Anyway, so you walk up you have to climb up that trough, and of course it's straight up on one side and straight down on the other, and you get up there, and it's a long ways down if you were to slip off of that trough, and finally you get to the top, and Terry and I helped me anyway, and well, everybody helped each other. But you get up to the top, and there's kind of a bowl there at the top. Again, you still have straight up on one side and straight down on the other, but there's this bowl, and the bottom of the bowl is missing. So and then it's like 300-400 feet straight down off of that, you know. Anyway, you had to climb around that hole and then back up onto a ledge, and then along a ledge in a place where you had to step around the back of a column, and put your foot on a ledge on the other side where you can't see the other side.
Okay.
And but you know, Terry was below me and others, you know, to help. So I just threw my foot around that column, and they grabbed it and put it on the ledge. And
cool.
And then once you get above that, then it's scrambled, but it's just gravel, you know, that you can go up, that you can climb up, and then you're up on top of the red wall, which is, so, you know, off to your right Zoroaster Temple and Rama Temple.
Right.
And on your right, of course, is the ledge, the ridge that goes out to Sumner Butte. So,
right.
Or on your left, I guess that would be. So we went to the left and out towards Sumner Butte, and Terry, so there's, anyway, so we got out to the ledge, and of course the ledge then turns directly south because it's the beginning of Sumner Butte. So we walked out that, and the sides just kept getting closer and closer, the right side and the left side of this ridge that we were on.
Mm-hmm.
Just getting closer and closer until you got to where it was only maybe 4 or 5 feet wide.
Wow.
And then there was a place where the ledge had fallen apart. It was missing. But it continued on the other side of this break in it, this place where it was missing. So the way you had to do it is to turn around and work yourself down on little, you know, it was like a bunch of layers of red of limestone that were sitting on top of each other, and you had to kind of make your way down backwards, and then when you got down about 6 feet down, you had to step backwards across this yawning gap onto a pedestal, and then from that pedestal you could turn around and go on out to the end of Sumner Butte. Well, Carrie and I looked at that and went, we're not going to do that. That just looks too dangerous. You know, I've got a full life to live. I don't really want to lose it here. And I mean, it's not worth it. Wasn't worth it to us to step across to do that.
Right.
But Magda and Billy, they did. They went ahead and did it and stepped out and went on to Sumner Butte. And then me and Terry then were on the north side of that gap.
Right.
And we just found a place where we could sit and look and look at the view from there, which was just tremendous.
I mean, you
were basically looking down at Phantom Canyon, and Buddha Temple was just right across from you, and you could see the north rim up to the right, and the south rim out to the left, and it was just a beautiful, an amazing place. And we just sat there looking at all this stuff, pointing it out to each other, going, "Wow, look at that!"
Nice,
etc. And then when they came back, then we made it back down to Phantom Ranch.
Nice.
That's one story.
Terry
Mache's story. Another one, or Terry Tobin. I mean, Terry Solar was, she had all kinds of energy, and she still does. And there was one time, here's another story. So there was a time when she and I had days off at the same time. It was, I think it was the 4th of July of maybe 76 or 77.
Okay.
And it's a big 4th of July, of course. This is 100 year, would that be 100 years?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
200th year.
200 years, that's it. Anyway, at the time, Terry and Dan Tobin and Terry Solar had developed a relationship with each other. And Dan was, at that time, had quit Phantom Ranch and was working for the trail crew.
Oh.
With all the, yeah. So, and the trail crew was, in that year, spending almost all their time, or they were spending all their time on the North Kaibab Trail. The North Kaibab Trail almost every year washes out near the top of it.
Okay.
Where the tunnel, the first tunnel is on the Kaibab,
yeah.
North Kaibab, just below that, there's a wash that comes down, and it washes out the trail almost every year.
Hmm.
Anyway, this year, this 76 of, it had washed out so badly that they didn't even have it open by the 4th of July.
Wow.
And so we have an electronic device going off over here. Hey, Amber. Well, anyway, I'll try to talk over it.
Okay.
We had that weekend off, the 4th of July, and we decided to go up to the North Rim. But again, the North Kaibab Trail was closed. You couldn't, you know, that part of the trail was completely closed, so you couldn't go up that way. So we had to go up the old Bright Angel. And the old Bright Angel is the old rust trail that goes up Bright Angel Canyon.
Right.
And ends up about 4 miles from the North Rim Village. So,
right.
Anyway, so Terry and I worked that the day before we went up there, and then And that evening, then, as soon as we were both off work, we grabbed our backpacks and started up the North Kaibab. And it was a full moon that night. So it was really a beautiful, hike. It was, of course, summer, July, so it was really warm. So good time to start with a full moon. And,
yeah.
And we hiked up there, and then, of course, neither of us had been on the North Kaibab Trail, on the Old Bright Angel before. And so we didn't really know it, but we knew kind of where it went. So we went up there, and by the time we got to the powerhouse, it was starting to get light.
Wow.
But we kept going, the trail goes it doesn't cross the creek where that bridge is at the powerhouse. It doesn't cross the creek and go up over to Roaring Springs Canyon. It stays in Bright Angel Canyon on the east side of the creek.
Mm-hmm.
So on up the creek we went, and then there's a place where eventually it comes down, and there were some cairns that showed you it was time to cross the creek. So we crossed the creek and then kept going, and then it crossed the creek again, came back over to that side, and kept going and across the creek a third time. I don't know how many times we crossed the creek before finally it started going up, and then it goes up to over a piece of what would that be, Supai Formation maybe?
Mm-hmm.
Rocks that and then you go along a ledge at the top of that rock, and then it goes back down to Bright Angel Creek. And you do that about three times before finally it comes up and starts, it goes up Fuller Canyon, which, eventually starts going up. Well, anyway, by the time I describe all this because I want you to realize how much time this is all taking. We got to a place where we could see the Coconino Sandstone was off to the left of us on the left side of Fuller Canyon. So from where we were hiking up, I'm pretty sure that's Fuller Canyon. But anyway, we were still, it was going uphill and uphill and uphill and uphill. And finally, I think we were about a third of the way up the Coconino Sandstone when I just laid down on the trail and went, I can't go any further. I'm so tired. Because, of course, we hadn't had any sleep the night before.
Right.
And we're doing all this work. So, and Terry, who is ahead of me, comes dancing back to the to where I was and says, "What are you doing?" I said, "I got to rest. I can't. Can we just take a little 10-minute nap or something?" And she goes, "Get up, you big baby. We're almost there."
Oh gosh!
And I look over and we're only a third of the way up the Coconino Sandstone. I said, "We can't be almost there. Look." She says, "Come on, So.
Hmm.
I drag myself to my feet again, and on up we, and we've laughed about that moment ever since. The
cool
big baby thing. And now we got up. So anyway, we got up to the top of the trail, and we're on the north rim, but of course we're still 4 miles from the village,
right,
where Dan is, and Dan is in the trail crew bunkhouse, which is part of the maintenance area of the North Rim. And So anyway, it's just 4 miles away, still 4 miles away. And I said, when we finally got there, I said, I've got to take a nap. I just can't stay awake any longer. And I laid down, and that was the last thing I remember until about, I don't know, maybe an hour later, I hear this click, boom, 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 and I look up, and Terry is not only up and just standing up, she's playing hacky sack, you know, with your legs, you know, boom,
yeah,
boom, boom, you know, trying to keep a ball in the air with your legs. And I'm like, how can you do that? And she said, come on, let's go. And, you know, so we
lots of energy.
4 miles over to the village. And,
oh, wow.
And it seemed to me that was, Topping was there, and he had a vehicle. So we actually, there was still snow on the north rim. I guess that means 76, 70, the winter of 75, 76 was really wet. So there was still snow on places on the north rim, and he took us, Topping took us all out to a place along Highway 67 there, where we pulled off the road and went, you know, over up a side canyon to the right of the one that 76 is in.
Okay.
And on a north facing slope was all covered with snow, so we stopped the car and all climbed over to the, you know, went over to this slope and skied down it with tennis shoes and shorts on.
Wow. Very cool.
So anyway, those are Terry Solar's stories.
Fun.
She and Dan eventually moved up to the South Rim, where Bob Sutton, there's another name, Bob Sutton,
yep,
and Larry Powell had been able to get a deal where they could live on the South Rim, I mean right on the rim of the canyon, at the mine, the old uranium mine that is out on Maricopa Point. So it's not quite Maricopa, but anyway,
that's the orphan mine.
Yeah, the Lost Orphan Mine. They had built these what was left of these buildings together, and actually created a really nice little kind of shack, but it was a building. It was, you know, strong enough to withstand winter. So, right on the rim. So, the actual building that they had made, that Bob Sutton had made, and that eventually he moved out of. And Terry and Dan moved in, was this building with a big picture windows right on the edge of the canyon looking out to the north.
Nice.
And
nice.
It had a huge wood-burning stove in it.
Hey, Keith.
Mm-hmm.
We've been going about an hour and 10 minutes.
Oh, okay.
I'm thinking maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this.
Okay, well, let me finish this by saying that's where Dan and Terry ended up living.
Okay. Right. Because I'm thinking, well, I want to hear more about Bob Sutton and Larry Powell, and I'm thinking that maybe John Martini, that would be Grizzly or Grizz, was in there.
Uh-huh.
And Deborah Ma, and so... It's just
let's just keep getting longer and longer.
Yeah. So
a lot of information there.
Yeah, so we'll come back to these folks next time.
Okay.
Cool. All right, so with that, this will conclude part 6, Oral History, with Keith and Nancy Green. Today is Wednesday, December 9th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Keith, thank you very much.
You bet.